This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Facing a fraught national moment, U.S. President Donald Trump was accepting his party's renomination on a massive White House South Lawn stage Thursday night, breaking with tradition by using the executive mansion as a political backdrop and defying pandemic guidelines to address a tightly packed, largely maskless crowd. Many in the crowd chanted four more years as Mr. Trump's daughter, Ivanka, before introducing him to speak, described why her father deserved to be reelected. Later, Mr. Trump said that he profoundly accepted his party's nomination. Then he went on to talk about the country's resolve, including how it will defeat the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, President Trump's Democratic opponents are branding him a first-term failure, AP correspondent Sagar Magani.
Joe Biden's accusing him of rooting for violence amid racial unrest, telling MSNBC the president sees it as a political benefit. That's after White House advisor Kellyanne Conway suggested on Fox that the unrest in Wisconsin could help the president's reelection chances. In an afternoon speech, Biden running mate Kamala Harris focused on the president's missteps amid the coronavirus pandemic, saying he failed the most basic part of the job.
He failed to protect the American people,
showing what she calls a reckless disregard for their well-being. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Threats from the remnants of Hurricane Laura are continuing hundreds of miles inland and well after nightfall. Forecasters have issued a string of tornado warnings for Mississippi and Arkansas, where Laura is now a tropical storm. No major damage has been reported from the twisters, but tornadoes can be particularly dangerous at night. The National Weather Service says Laura could dump as much as 7 inches of rain on Arkansas alone as it continues moving north away from Louisiana. This is VOA News. Repeated calls for armed vigilantes to travel to Kenosha, Wisconsin to protect businesses following the police shooting of Jacob Blake spread across social media in the hours before two people were shot to death and a third was wounded. Researchers at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab said in a Wednesday blog post that multiple threats on Facebook and Reddit urged militias and their armed people to head to the protest. Two people were killed by gunfire Tuesday during a third night of unrest. Kyle Rittenhouse, a white 17-year-old from nearby Antioch, Illinois, has been arrested on suspicion of first-degree intentional homicide. Russian police have announced a preliminary probe into the circumstances of the sudden illness of opposition politician Alexei Navalny. AP's Karen Shamas has details.
President Putin's fiercest critic fell into a coma last week following a suspected poisoning as pressure has grown from Western officials to investigate. The Siberian branch of Russia's Interior Ministry has announced that it is establishing all the circumstances of the incident. Authorities say it will conduct forensic studies and collect items that may have probative value. Navalny, an opposition politician and corruption investigator, fell ill on a flight back to Moscow from Siberia and was taken to a hospital in the Siberian city of Omsk. He was later transferred to Charité Hospital in Berlin. I'm Karen Chamas.
COVID-19 cases and deaths continue to rise, with approximately 830,000 deaths globally, more than 24.3 million confirmed infections. The U.S. continues to lead in both deaths and infections, followed by Brazil, Mexico in third in deaths, followed by India, while India ranks third in infections, followed by Russia. Australia's prime minister said Friday he was open to discussions over whether Australian mass killer Brenton Tarrant, jailed for life without parole this week for the New Zealand mosque shooting, should serve his sentence in his home country. Scott Morrison told the broadcaster Channel 7 he had not received a formal request from New Zealand for such a transfer, although New Zealand Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters suggested it after Tarrant was sentenced Thursday. Tarrant, who grew up in a rural town north of Sydney, admitted to 51 charges of murder, 40 counts of attempted murder, and one charge of committing a terrorist act, with the 2019 shooting rampage at two mosques in Christchurch. Taliban fighters killed four civilians who were fleeing areas hit by devastating floods during clashes with Afghan forces in Parwan province Thursday. That's according to a district official in Bagram. The flash floods, which have now left at least 150 people dead, were brought on by exceptionally heavy rain over the weekend. Find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 28th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. West African leaders are meeting today on the crisis in Mali.
ECOWAS is also saying that the transition process will be either 6 or 9 months or maximum 12 months. The military leaders are saying 3 years, but they were not democratically elected, so they can't lay claim.
Some Ivorians want French President Macron's intervention in their country's apparent constitutional crisis. A humanitarian gesture for some Gambian women stranded in Lebanon. Malawi sees increases in pregnancies and early marriages because of COVID-19 lockdown. And Kenyans debate constitutional amendment 10 years after its adoption.
The constitution was a work in progress. And as such, we were made to adopt it with a promise that in the future, we will make it better. 10 years later, the moment to improve on it, I believe, is now.
And Botswana seeks amendment to its laws to curb a rise in statelessness. The stories plus Samse O'Malley sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Heads of state of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, are meeting today, Friday, in an extraordinary session on the socio-political crisis in Mali. The meeting comes as the National Committee for the Salvation of the People, the ruling military junta, announced on Thursday that it had freed deposed President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta from detention. But it appears there is a stalemate between the position of the regional leaders and that of the military junta. The junta wants to lead a 3-year transitional government, but ECOWAS wants no more than a year. Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He says ECOWAS mediator and former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan briefed President Buhari on Thursday ahead of the meeting.
ECOWAS, through the special envoy of former Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan, made some demands and requests from the military leaders in Mali, where one of them has been met that the ousted president should be allowed to go back to his private residence. I see that that has been met. But ECOWAS is also saying that the transition process should be either 6 or 9 months or maximum 12 months. The military leaders are saying 3 years, but they were not democratically elected, so they can't lay claim to the remainder of President Keita's term. So ECOWAS is insisting that this must be as short as possible. And they are saying that even in those 12 months, the government that is going to be set up should be headed by a civilian or a retired military officer. They don't want a serving military person to head the government of interim national government of the sector. Those are issues ECOWAS will take decisions on Friday.
The military leaders are talking about sanctions. They say that the sanctions imposed by ECOWAS are hurting Mali.
Well, yes, they want the sanctions that are in place now to be relaxed. They also acquiesce to some of the requests by ECOWAS. Or on the flip side, the sanctions can be further tightened. So it depends on what they come up with. If they come up with what we can call a faithful position, then ECOWAS will also respond faithfully to that.
So as things stand now, it seems to me there's a stalemate.
Well, we can't say definitively that it's a stalemate until the extraordinary summit of Friday is concluded, because you never know what will be brought to the table. One of the requests was that the president should be released. Now he's been released. We also don't know what will come up in terms of latest information, particularly in respect to who leads the interim national government and for how long that government will last.
Would ECOWAS like for these talks to include the civilian movement that has been leading the protest?
Not likely, but the mediator, former Nigerian president, in his briefing to President Buhari on Wednesday, said he also met with those civilian leaders.
Femi Adesina is the special advisor on media and publicity to Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari. He was speaking with us from the capital, Abuja. A former Ivory Coast prime minister has petitioned French President Emmanuel Macron to intervene in the decision by President Alassane Ouattara to seek a third term in office. Guillaume Soro, a former rebel leader, says the president will be violating the constitution if he seeks another term. This after serving 2 5-year terms. Soro and former President Laurent Gbagbo were recently barred by election authorities to contest in the October election. Some Ivorians say the president's decision to seek a third term will come with a cost. Others, however, say he has a strong chance of winning. VOA's Peter Clottis spoke with independent media specialist Eric Atnauro in Abidjan about the call for French President Macron's intervention.
People think that Soro Guillaume is right in asking France to intervene because considering the ties that France has with the country, because what is coming up could be very, very much dangerous for the region concerning the front against terrorism. The whole region can be destabilized. So it's more than necessary that France step in now before it gets too late, because we all know that it ends up in France, or France being the superpower at the Security Council in the United Nations.
Yeah. Eric, are people expressing fear that the security situation could get worse in Ivory Coast because of the decision of President Ouattara to seek a third term?
Oh, definitely, because, you know, it's always our election that problems occur here. And this time, people are afraid. I talked to one of the leaders when it comes to private sector here. He's even looking for a visa to go cool down a little bit, maybe in France or somewhere else. We saw, like, in one day, almost 10 people, you know, got killed. Women went out to protest. It's dangerous. And we're hearing the same rhetoric about, you know, who's Ivorian, who's not. And even people have the feeling that 10 years after that horrible war, you know, that was said to repair the insult that was done to people who are not maybe 100% or another origin in Africa. It's ridiculous, and then it's very painful for the people to come back to the same issue.
I understand supporters of former President Laurent Gbagbo have decided that they are going to petition to have his name restored as a candidate for the elections, despite CNE or the Electoral Commission saying he's not qualified.
You know, the opposition is paying for a lack of unity and a lack of vision. The same opposition, some of them, you know, except, you know, Laurent Gbagbo's party, most of them went to vote for the actual constitution. So we don't know if the constitution really, you know, allows this Ouattara. Today, the opposition cannot do much because they were the ones who called to vote for this constitution. But also, they're trying to survive. Laurent Gbagbo is the major stakeholder in this crisis. If Laurent Gbagbo is not here, there won't be no reconciliation. Going for this candidacy, even though they know that he won't be able to be retained as a candidate, but that shows the response to that problem is not only about, you know, who can run or only about laws and regulations. It's a political problem. It's therefore a political solution that will, you know, end this pre-electoral crisis. It's a political situation. So Gbagbo and his partisans are still, insisting, knowing that maybe ultimately all the cards will be reshuffled, and then a political deal will come up.
That was independent media specialist Eric Agnaro speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty from Ivory Coast capital, Abidjan. 38 Gambian women and children are on their way home to Gambia from Lebanon after the head of nonprofit Action for Humanity heard about their plight via social media and intervened. Lovette Jallow, the Gambian-Swedish founder of Action for Humanity, said she coordinated with her board members to arrange and pay for tickets for the Gambian nationals after hearing about them being stranded in Lebanon following the blast that killed 200 people last month. Jallow spoke to Ricky Stryak about their plans.
They added me to a group chat on WhatsApp, and everybody was explaining their story and how much they want to leave. And that is basically the beginning of the project, of a beginning of me understanding that there are actually Gambian people, a group of them, a large group of them that nobody was talking about at all. Nobody was mentioning Gambian women. All of the news sites were discussing the Kenyan women, the Nigerian women, the Ethiopian women, the Eritrean women. And I guess that is normal because Gambia is the smallest country in Africa. So when we are involved in natural disasters like the one in Beirut, we don't always get mentioned. We almost get erased out of the narrative.
How did you mobilize to get the funds and the political will in order to repatriate these women?
I run an NGO, so funds were readily available for this project. I just didn't know that this was going to be the project that those funds would be allocated to. There is no political will. I am not a political person. I'm not a politician. I'm just a humanitarian. So this issue in Lebanon of repatriating these Gambian women has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with humanitarian effort. And when it comes to the planning, it had a very rocky start in terms of the Gambian government not being very helpful in the matter, but that has changed. We have a positive outlook on that now.
And why was it so important, do you think, to help them get home?
It's important because as a Gambian national, I'm a dual national citizenship. So I'm Swedish and Gambian. As a Gambian citizen, I believe that Gambia being 2 million, everybody just assumes that we are not needing any extra help when we're in the diaspora, and we possibly need the most help because we are the smallest group of people, maybe one of the quietest group of people, and the ones most easily erased from this narrative. So for me, as a Gambian person, it was very important to immediately act because I knew the reality. I was talking to these women almost every hour of every day with updates on what was happening. So for me, it was just, it's a call of duty.
Do you think this speaks to a larger issue of women who are working very hard and who are often left behind or whose voices aren't heard by the authorities?
I think that this speaks to a larger issue of Black women. It speaks to a larger issue of us not having a tendency to not listen to the needs and the rules and the regulations that surround Black bodies. All of these countries have rules and regulations for women. You don't beat them, you don't abuse them. If they're in your employment, you pay them. Those rules are easily enforced when the women are Arab, but unfortunately not enforced when the women are Black African women. So it speaks to an issue that has been ongoing for 70 years in the MENA countries, in the Arab countries. It speaks to the issue of the inability of Saudi as the head of the kafala system enforcing the rules and the laws that surround work. And it's abysmal because this is not new. This has been ongoing for 70 years.
That was Lovett Jallow, founder of Action for Humanity. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Sweden. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, August 28th. 10 years ago yesterday, Kenya adopted a new constitution. Now, there are mixed reactions from citizens as some leaders are asking for amendments to some sections of the document. Some argue that the current constitution has not benefited Kenyans and that it is full of flaws. As Maureen Ochiambo reports from Nairobi, President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga are both pushing for a referendum to amend the constitution.
Plans to change the new constitution have gained momentum fueled by the Building Bridges Initiative, a project of President Uhuru Kenyatta and his handshake partner, Raila Odinga, in what has been blamed on the fallout of Deputy President William Ruto, who no longer attends key government functions with the president. Deputy President William Ruto and his close allies see the plans to change the constitution as a plot to lock him out of the presidential contest in 2022 when President Kenyatta completes his second and final term in office. Speaking in Nairobi, President Uhuru Kenyatta said that the current constitution has been upheld globally. However, it requires changes and that the changes should happen as soon as possible.
The constitution was a work in progress, and as such, we were made to adopt it with a promise that in the future, we will make it better. 10 years later, the moment to improve on it, I believe, is now. We must not, as a people, succumb to the paralysis of constitutional rigidity. We must treat a constitution as a living being, as a living document that must constantly adjust to our emerging realities.
On the other hand, the opposition leader Raila Odinga said that the amendments for the constitution should be implemented to accommodate other needs. Raila says it's time to relook at the document to review what is not working for Kenyans.
That's why we are saying that a constitution is a living document. It is not something that is static. You review it each time to see if there is a need for changes. We have lived with this constitution for 10 years, so it was time for us to relook at it and see which one is working, which one is not working. This was an experiment. And now is the time to review even those amendments which were introduced at Naivasha.
Kenyans, however, have got mixed reactions about the new constitution. A Kenyan, Mason Owino, said that there are some loopholes that should be looked into as most Kenyans' expectations have not been achieved.
We expected a lot when the constitution was promulgated in 2010. There are a lot of gains that we've had. There are a lot of sections that we've also failed to implement. I can say in terms of gains, the constitution has brought a lot of changes. We've seen resources being devolved to county governments, which of course is a plus to the economy of the country. However, there are a lot of issues that are yet to be implemented.
As Kenyans mark 10 years of new constitution, a recent survey released by Amnesty International Kenya says that 60% of Kenyans want the current constitution implemented instead of amending it. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Botswana will amend its laws to curb the rise in statelessness. More than 15,000 people in the country are stateless. The Southern African country requires children born to a citizen and foreigner to renounce the citizenship of their foreign parents of country, and failing to do so makes them stateless. Kundise Dube has the details from Habaroni.
Most of the stateless persons were born in Botswana and have one parent who is a citizen and one who is an immigrant. When they turn 21, a person must choose their preferred nationality and renounce the citizenship of the other country. If they do not renounce the other country's citizenship, they lose their Botswana citizenship, but they often are unable to take up citizenship in the other parent's homeland. Botswana Minister of Immigration Anna Muketi told Parliament this week the government is reviewing the Citizenship Act.
Will make a deliberate decision to approach the ministry, and renounce their Botswana citizenship if they don't want their Botswana citizenship. Otherwise, if they want their Botswana citizenship, then there is no act required of them. They continue to be Botswana citizens.
She said a lack of public information of the process resulted in people becoming stateless.
The reason why most people fall into statelessness is on account of not having sufficient information about the Citizenship Act. It's unfortunately on account of ignorance.
25-year-old Anita Butale is one of those who lost her citizenship.
Trying for the past 3 years to normalize, I was not aware that I had to renounce since I have held Botswana citizenship from birth. It will be a welcome development to relook into the laws.
The government will carry out countrywide tours to educate the public on the changes. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
Malawi has one of the highest rates of early marriage and teenage pregnancy in the world, with about half of girls marrying before the age of 18, according to government records. Aid groups say the coronavirus closing of schools have worsened the trend, which they are trying to reverse. Malawian authorities are also engaging health facilities to distribute contraceptives as protection from unintended pregnancies. Lamek Masina reports from Palombe District in southern Malawi.
A 17-year-old girl from the Palombe District, who we will call Rhoda, says she became hopeless when the government closed the schools in March as a measure against the spread of COVID-19, like many other girls in poor rural areas, where schools provide only a favorite pastime. Rhoda struggled to find ways to make money. She says we instead resorted to go about places doing peace jobs to earn money. But when the peace jobs became scarce, I had no other option but to start a relationship with a man. A resulting pregnancy led to another challenge after her parents kicked the primary school student out of their home. Rhoda says the problem she faces is lack of food and clothes. She says the man who impregnated her sometimes brings her some food, but it is not enough. Rhoda is among thousands of Malawian girls negatively impacted by the closure of schools due to the coronavirus pandemic. The problem of teenage pregnancies is not new in Malawi. Government records show about half of girls marrying before the age of 18. A teenager mother, we will call Joyce, says poverty is to blame for her predicament. Joyce says many men promise to buy us things like smartphones, shoes, and clothes. This is what lured me into having sex with a man, but he never gave me any of these. In a bid to reverse the trend, the Center for Alternatives for Victimized Women and Children is encouraging youths to access sexual reproductive health, or SRHS, services, which include the use of condoms. Linda Almoso is a program officer with the center.
We're conducting awareness to these youth as well as their parents, because we managed to establish some youth clubs so that these youth should be meeting in their free time and discuss the importance of accessing these SRHR services.
The organization says it is also empowering women's groups to help children leave their marriages. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Palombe, Southern Malawi.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports in Liberia, where that country's football association has announced the contract extension of the senior national team head coach Peter Butler. LFA president Mustafa Raji announced that the contract of Butler had been extended by a year after consultations with the country's Ministry of Youth and Sports. Butler was confirmed as Lone Star coach in August 2019 in a one-year contract. And now to Uganda, where the Federation of Uganda Football Association has indicated that when matches resume, it will be played behind closed doors. Uganda Premier League club representatives have indicated a burning eagerness to return to action. As of today, no top-flight league match has been held for nearly 6 months. FUFA president Moses Magogo says when FUBA eventually returns, it will be played without the fans.
We are likely to go in situations according to what we are negotiating with government. Resumption of football may be without fans. We don't know for how long. And we know that the fans pay. Meaning that we must take football to the people via television. And for me, the challenge is not they will televise the matches or not. For me, the challenge is the untelevised matches.
And now to Egypt, where Al Ahly players underwent rapid COVID-19 tests on Thursday on the instructions of the Egyptian Football Association, which decided earlier this week to replace the current PCR test with an antibody blood test. The EFA said in July, while listing the preventive measures required on restarting the domestic league, that PCR tests will be mandatory for all players before games, stressing that the football governing body will run and bear the costs of the tests. However, due to the elevated cost, the EFA has instructed clubs to switch to the rapid tests. And now to athletics. Ahead of next Wednesday's Diamond League meeting in Lausanne, Kenyan World 1500 meters champion Timothy Cheruiyot, who won his second Diamond League meet on Sunday after the lockdown, will revive his rivalry with Jakob Ingebrigtsen of Norway, the European 1500 meters champion. Norwegian Jakob Ingebrigtsen tried for the 11th time to beat the world champion, but the lanky Cheruiyot proved his impeccable mettle, gliding to victory in a more composed run as compared to last weekend's win in Monaco. Cheruiyot says he's working hard to keep his rival at bay.
Now Jakob is coming fast, and I need to work harder because...
And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good weekend. And that's it for this Friday, August 28th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.